It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. A sincere thank you to everyone who has contributed so far today to our fall fundraising campaign. If you have not taken care of that business yet, please do so during the Current State Hour, 517-353-5000. Thank you very much for your support of WKAR. Earlier this year, a disturbing photograph from a small Ohio town captured the reality of America's opioid abuse crisis. It showed a man and a woman slumped over in the front seat of a car on the brink of death with a young child in the back seat. The photo went viral after local police posted it online. Opioids are pain relief medications, extremely effective and potentially extremely addictive. Hydrocodone, also known as Vicodin, oxycodone, also known as OxyContin, and many other related drugs. Michigan is also struggling with the opioid epidemic. Today on Current State, we'll talk about treatment strategies being used here in Michigan. My guests are Dr. Narasimha Gundamraj, a pain management specialist with Sparrow Health Systems in Lansing. Dr. Gundamraj, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Also, George Long is with us. He is the office manager and patient liaison with Bloomfield Internal Medicine Associates in Bloomfield Hill. Thank you for being here, George.
Glad to be here.
Dr. Raj, can you help us understand what makes opioids so potentially addictive?
Opioids are very effective pain management medications. It's the structure of the opioids and where they act in the brain that makes them potentially addictive and potentially abusive. Mm-hmm. They work on opioid receptors in the brain, which also are closely related to the reward centers in the brain that the other illegal substances and drugs work in. Mm-hmm. So there is a mechanism where they not only treat pain, but they also can be abusive and they can be addictive if not used in the proper way.
Over the last couple of years, we have seen such a huge rise in reported cases of opioid overdoses across the country. What's accounted for this surge in these cases?
Well, I'm seeing at our practice the prevalence of access. Those patients have access through either nefarious sources, out on the street, or they go and see a physician for a reason that is not genuine. Mm-hmm. So they may be able to acquire medication through surreptitious methods, or they may have initially started as a genuine patient, and through discontinuing of that necessary medication, they found themselves dependent or addicted, mm-hmm. and they have to go to the street to keep that up because the fear of the withdrawal is very potent.
Dr. Gundamraj, explain to us how you come into contact with people who are addicted to opioids. What are the circumstances?
In my practice, I see patients who are already on opioids. They're coming from their primary care doctors. They've been on opioids for a few months or years, and out of the fear of what's going on outside in the outside world about opioids, some of these patients are not prescribed the opioids that they need, and they're referred to us for expert opinion. So these are the most common patients that we see in our practice who are being treated with opioids.
George, what about you?
Well, we're seeing a lot of patients that they may have chronic issues, and we treat some of those at our practice, and others we refer over to doctor for pain management that are a little more expert in that regard. They can maintain a quality of life. So those pain medications are very necessary for certain folks, but mm-hmm. for others, we see them, and it's our take that we need to help them get stable. So we work on treating them.
Is there a difference between opioid addiction and dependency? Should we think of those things as the same thing, or are they different?
They are different. A lot of people get confused between opioid addiction and dependence. When somebody's taking opioids for a longer period, their body gets dependent on them. So when they stop taking the opioids, they go into withdrawal. That's dependence. Addiction is a disease. It's a neurobiologic disease. There's changes inside the brain which are sometimes irreversible. When you're talking about addiction, patients are taking medications when they don't need those medications for that particular condition. Mm. They know that the medications are causing harm, but they're still taking it. And there's a craving for these medications, and if the patients cannot get these medications, then they're going outside to get these medications in illegal ways. That's addiction.
We're talking about opioid addiction and treatment regimens as well. Dr. Narasimha Gundamraj is an anesthesiologist with Sparrow Health Systems in Lansing. George Long is also with us. Mr. Long is the patient liaison with Bloomfield Internal Medicine Associates in Bloomfield Hills. George, what is the rehab process for an opioid addict? How gradually or quickly must a person be weaned off whatever drug they're on?
That's a very, you know, specialized question for each individual. Some patients, they've gone through so many ups and downs that they will get to a point where they say, I've had enough, and they're willing to go to the lengths of cold turkey, which is, you know, to discontinue opioids, whether it's a street illicit such as heroin or something that's being prescribed for pain. I've had enough, and they will go cold turkey, which is a very difficult process, full of the physical withdrawal symptoms, which are very, very uncomfortable. Or the weaning down process is a step-by-step process of reducing the intake of those opioids at a point where the patient can tell that there's a bit of discomfort, but you have to make progress.
Dr. Raj, what role does family history play in a person's susceptibility to opioids? Can you have a genetic predisposition to drug abuse, meaning you've got opioid receptors in your body that you might not be able to switch off?
Science has shown this. Addiction has a genetic predisposition. It's mainly studied in alcoholic disorders, although lately there's been studies going on with opioids also. So in general, addiction in itself has a genetic predisposition. First-degree relatives of patients who have histories of addiction are high-risk patients. And as a physician, whenever we prescribe opioids for pain purposes, we look at all these factors before we initiate somebody on opioid therapy. Their family history, their current state, their psychological tests that we can do to assess a patient if they are the right candidates for opioid therapy.
Let's get into the treatment here a little bit more deeply. George Long, what's the rehab? You administer a program involving Vivitrol. That's the brand name for a powerful so-called antagonistic drug. How does that work?
Yes, we're one of the few prescribers in treatment facilities that offer, in an outpatient setting, the Vivitrol medication, which is a monthly injection of naltrexone that is time-released and lasts all month. And it's an antagonist, means it's not an opioid, but it works on the same receptors, these mu receptors that are processing opioids. And so for patients who have gone through rehab or have become detoxed, this is a medication. The indication is to prevent relapse, and it's very effective at preventing opioid relapse.
To what extent do we rely on drugs or other drugs to fight addictions to drugs, Dr. Raj?
Most of the drugs that are used to treat addiction are antagonists, like George said. It's not just the drugs that that are used to treat addiction. Addiction treatment is a comprehensive treatment process. It involves medication treatment like Vivitrol, which has been used for prevention of opioid addiction relapse. It also involves treatment with mental health facilities, social services. These are very important in treating addiction. It's not just the medication treatment.
What's lacking right now that you could use more of, or that we don't have enough of at all?
Oh, boy, where do we begin? The first order of business is education. The folks who come to us and are ready, to make that change, the patient has to have it in their head that they want to make change. But those folks are stunned if we get them on Vivitrol and they feel fabulous. Like, I wish I knew about this 5 years ago or 10 years ago. This is some great big secret. That's how they feel. But there is good press out there, and there is good information getting out. And we have relationships with rehab facilities that when folks come through and they're starting down the path of change, they're referred over to us to continue that good progress.
We've been talking about strategies for treating opioid addiction. George Long is the patient liaison with Bloomfield Internal Medicine Associates in Bloomfield Hills. We also want to thank Dr. Narasimha Gundamraj. He is an anesthesiologist with Sparrow Health Systems in Lansing. Thank you for being here.
Glad Thanks to be for here. Having me.
State on 90.5 WKAR. Thank you for joining us. Tomorrow night, the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame will induct its class of 2016. The honorees include 9 women and 1 women's organization. Who are this year's inductees and why were they chosen? Caitlin Dial is here with the answers. Caitlin's the interim executive director of the Michigan Women's Historical Center and Hall of Fame on Malcolm X Street in Lansing. Thank you for joining us, Caitlin.
Thank you for having me here.
Talk to us about the center and the Hall of Fame. What do visitors find when they go there?
Well, we're a small museum, but we have our Hall of Fame. Currently, we have 298 plaques up on the wall of incredible Michigan women, from stories for education, civil rights, union rights, you name it. We have a woman who represents that story.
Mm. You've been at it how long down there?
Almost a year.
Okay. All right. So you're still kind of new at the job. You're learning an awful lot about historical figures throughout Michigan.
Yes.
Great Michigan women. 5 of this year's inductees are in the contemporary category. Describe the different categories you work with here.
So every year we induct women into our Hall of Fame into 2 categories: contemporary, meaning that they're still living, and historical, meaning that they've already passed.
Okay. And a couple of them in the contemporary category who are still living are certainly familiar names here to everyone here in Lansing and in Michigan. Motown music legend Diana Ross.
Yes. Yes.
Pretty understandable why she would be in a Hall of Fame, but tell us more about what went into that decision.
Well, we garner nominations from people throughout the state. So we don't put up these women, we don't select them, and then we have judges review those nominations. So it was really the nomination that was put forth for Diana Ross, chosen by our judges, with her incredible achievements throughout her life, being the Motown legend, but also a great solo artist, and with also her significant achievements for women and other causes that she supports.
Okay. How many inductees altogether here tomorrow night?
Tomorrow night we have 10 inductees, 9 individual women and 1 women's group, and then we have 1 man going into the Hall of Fame.
And you do that every year, I understand. We'll learn more about that in just a minute. We'll learn about that. This is the recipient of the Philip Hart Award, the legendary Michigan senator here. One of the other 2 local women in this year's Hall of Fame class is certainly a very familiar name to everyone across Michigan, Michigan State University President Luanna Simon.
Yes. The first woman president of Michigan State University and the 20th president here at the university. An incredible woman. I personally got to see the films that we produced to honor the 10 women that go into the Hall of Fame last night. And she is a phenomenal speaker, and she has done so much for the state of women, especially here at the university, in working with Title IX and increasing the level of female athletes here at the university, but also in her personal career, being the first female provost, being the first female president here at the university. She's really done a lot.
We've got another person from Lansing, a Lansing educator, who is also closely identified with advances in education, Dr. Olivia Letts, the first African-American hired to teach in the Lansing School District. Tell us more.
Yes, she is a lovely woman, and she will even say that that she wasn't held back by the color of her skin, but she really did so much for people of color here in the city of Lansing and for the school district and for teachers. And she is well-loved by the community here in Lansing. There's the Lett Center that's located right here in Lansing, named for her and her husband for everything that they do for the people here in this town.
Of course, her work involved desegregation efforts and hiring more teachers of color in the Lansing School District, besides being the first African-American hired to teach in Lansing. A couple of the other contemporary inductees, Dr. Anand Amary of Detroit, and the Reverend Faith Fowler of Detroit. Tell us about these two.
Yes, Dr. Anand Amary, she's the founder of the National Arab American Museum in Dearborn. And Reverend Faith Fowler is the founder and executive director of Cass Community Social Services in Detroit. You've heard about the tiny houses that are being built currently in the city of Detroit for the homeless and those who can't afford larger mortgages. That's her organization that's spearheading that effort.
We're talking with Caitlin Dial of the Michigan Women's Historical Center and Hall of Fame about the Hall's 2016 class of honorees being inducted tomorrow night. Now, some of these names on the historical side of the ledger are probably less familiar. They were active many, many years ago, but still you consider them worthy of some recognition. We've got Elizabeth Sparks Adams, who served 54 years on the Michigan Historical Commission. Daisy Elliott of Detroit, who lived almost to the age of 100. Another civil rights leader and former state representative. What can you tell us about those two?
Oh, Daisy Elliott was a phenomenal woman, and she's the co-author of the Elliott-Larsen Act that we have here in the state of Michigan that protects us for all civil rights here. And she's really one of the first women to, or she's one of the 11 women who had a say in our current state constitution. She was a force to be reckoned with in the state legislature, and we're so proud to have her recognized in the Hall of Fame.
Others here in the historical category, Dr. Evelyn Golden, who practiced medicine in Flint for nearly 50 years, specializing in the care of women and children. Lottie Lewis of Niles, Michigan, a nationally renowned artist whose works were displayed at the White House.
Yes.
A black woman who also worked in education, civil rights, and women's suffrage. So a long list of inductees here for tomorrow night. You're inducting an organization as well here. Let's talk a minute about that. The Mary Freebed Guild in Grand Rapids.
Yes. So if you're familiar with the Mary Freebed Hospital in Grand Rapids, that was originally started as the Mary Freebed Guild, where a group of women in 1891 wanted to fund a free bed for anyone who couldn't afford health care at a local hospital. So they passed a purse and asked anyone named Mary, which was the most common name at the time for women, to donate 10 cents. And within a short amount of period of time, they had enough money to fund that free bed. Thus, the Mary Freebed Guild was formed.
And we alluded to the Philip Hart Award earlier. This is when you acknowledge one man every year. Who's the winner of this year's Philip Hart Award?
So this year is the Honorable Damon J. Keith. We give that award away to a man who has made significant achievements in helping women advance themselves in their careers or are particularly focused in advancing women. So Damon J. Keith, he has been a mentor for the former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm, current Dean of Wayne State University's Law School Jocelyn Benson, and others. So he's been a supporter of women and their careers and also of black attorneys.
The Michigan Women's Hall of Fame will induct its class of 2016 tomorrow night with a ceremony at MSU's Kellogg Hotel and Conference Center. I'm told the ceremony is actually sold out, but you put together a waiting list, correct?
Yes, yes. We don't want anyone to miss out. So as we have people drop their seats, we're adding people in.
There's a reception at 5, a dinner at 6, the program at 7. We want to thank Caitlin Dial, Interim Executive Director of the Michigan Women's Historical Center and Hall of Fame. Thank you, Caitlin. Have fun tomorrow night.
Thank you.
Every Tuesday, Current State takes a closer look at Michigan's environment. Over time, scientists are learning more about contaminants and how much they can threaten the water, the air, and people. That's why the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, the DEQ, is preparing to update its cleanup criteria that involve substances like petroleum, chemicals, fertilizer, and others. A public comment period on proposed revisions ends today. So what recent science should DEQ incorporate into its cleanup procedures? James Clift is the longtime policy director for the Michigan Environmental Council. He and the MEC have some thoughts on the process. Welcome back, James.
Thank you.
As I understand it, DEQ opened this process with some proposed revisions. If you can keep this simple for the non-scientists listening, what has the agency put on the table?
Yeah, so they've been working for about a year and looking at a list of about 300 chemicals. And on each of those, they looked at what's the latest health studies that have been done on that chemical. And they're looking at toxicity, especially toxicities to humans, and trying to figure out, okay, does this number need to be lower or higher to make sure that we're protecting public health in Michigan?
What's in there that you like? What's in there that you don't think goes far enough?
Well, these updates are long overdue. Some of these chemicals have not been revised for 25 years, so it was time to put the effort into looking at each one of these and updating those numbers. That's what we'd like.
It seems as if MEC has responded with recommendations more about the process than about the particular contaminants? I mean, do I have that right?
You have that right. We don't want to wait 25 years again to update them the next time. We've got them updated. We think the process should include some streamlined method for making sure when new science emerges, new health studies come out, that those can quickly be incorporated into agency decision-making to make sure we continue to protect public and don't kind of get behind science like we are today.
One of your main points you reiterated in a letter to DEQ dated just yesterday, you wrote, and I'll quote here, "Our primary concern is that the administrative rules have been used by the department as a reason for not fulfilling its statutory obligation to protect the Michigan public." Unpack that for us, please. What do you mean?
Yeah, so what they do is they have a algorithm that they run through these toxicity numbers to come up with that final cleanup number. What they've done in the past is that final number gets included inside of the administrative rule. So even though new science has come out and new studies have come out, they said, oh, we're locked into the number that's in the administrative rule.
The
we can't consider the new science. Mm. We say that's backwards. The statute tells you to protect public health. You can't then use an administrative rule to block that from happening.
Mm. You go on to say that new science is not being incorporated into the regulatory framework here in Michigan, and you say we need a new process. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so last year, actually, the air toxics program that looks into the emission of air pollutants, toxic chemicals, we revised that process, and we've got a new process there where when they decide that they're going to look at a chemical and look at the science, they basically announce it. They announce it to the public. The industry can look at the science. The public can look at the science. Everybody can give the department kind of their best knowledge of where they think it should go. And then the department determines a new level, in that case, for emissions from air pollutants, from smokestacks. But a very similar process that is designed to incorporate that new science in a way that everyone has their kind of their day in court. They get to present the science as they see it before the department sets that new number. We think the same sort of process needs to be incorporated by this division.
This process actually began months ago. Is there a consensus about the things that MEC stands for, or are you a voice in the wilderness here? Do you feel like there's consensus among environmental groups, at least, that what you're calling for would be widely supported?
Again, I think there's definitely consensus within the environmental group. And in the air toxic program, we actually came to an agreement with the Michigan Manufacturers Association on the process to be included in that program. So I think there's growing consensus within the department, hopefully, that this is a good way to incorporate new science going forward, and I'm hoping to see them expand it through this rule package.
James Clift is the longtime policy director for the Michigan Environmental Council. We're talking here today about a public comment period involving updating the DEQ's cleanup criteria. Criteria that ends up involving substances like petroleum, chemicals, fertilizers, and other, and really getting the latest science into the DEQ's processes. You go on to say that the state's current standards, quote, only allows science that weakens standards, unquote, which sounds like quite an indictment. No science becomes relevant that improves standards?
Yeah, again, and this is a quirk in how this program works, where a company can request a site-specific number, and they in that site-specific investigation, they look at some of the properties of the site, but they can also look at the science and change the number. So when a company wants them to look at the science on a site-specific basis, the department is allowed to do so. But if a community was to raise new science, the statute doesn't allow that. We think that's pretty backwards, that we need new science to move either direction. And that's how we found it did in this revision of the packages. Some of the numbers went down, some of them went up, all based on kind of new health studies that have been conducted.
As I said, the public comment period actually goes back a number of months. Have you gotten any kind of response from DEQ, Manufacturers Association, any other stakeholders here regarding what you are recommending?
Yeah, we recently met with Director Heidi Grether and people from the governor's office looking at our proposal, and I thought they were definitely giving it a fair look. They were looking to see whether or not this is a portion of the proposal they should include in the rule package. So we're hopeful that they're going to adopt this as a method to make sure that they don't get, again, lost in the regulation and forget their main mission of protecting public health and making sure that we're using the best science to do that.
Now, your organization, the Michigan Environmental Council, commends DEQ for pursuing the update. As you pointed out, though, you feel it's overdue. How often should a review like this take place?
Well, what we like to think about is if they kind of did it constantly, where they had just maybe, you know, half a dozen, a dozen chemicals a year they're looking at, they could keep all of the chemicals kind of updated, and they could take nominations for which ones maybe new science has come in on. So again, have it be an ongoing process so that you don't let yourself get way behind. And again, unfortunately, there were some chemicals that have been more than 20 years since they've been updated at this time.
Now, the agency has had to respond to the Flint water crisis. Is that any justification here or part of a reason that the delay has taken, or it's taken as long as you say?
Again, it's taken a lot of their resources, but really that's only been the last year, 18 months. This has been a 20-year problem in the making. So again, in the short term, maybe that's true, but not over the long term.
We will point out for our morning listeners, at least, that there is a two-hour public comment session to which the public is obviously invited this afternoon, 1 to 3 p.m. at Lansing Community College West. That's at 5708 Cornerstone Drive on the west side. Email comments will be accepted until the end of the day at the following email address, deq-rrdcriteria@michigan.gov. That's deq-rrdcriteria@michigan.gov. We want to thank James Clift, Policy Director for the Michigan Environmental Council, for joining us here on this segment. Thank you, James.
Thank you, Mark. The public hearing actually was yesterday. So
thank you for the correction.
But they are taking comments through the end of today.
Very good. We appreciate the clarification. Thank you, James. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, in these final 2 weeks before Election Day, candidates are wrapping up their personal appeals to potential voters. Tonight in Lansing, contenders for three state house districts plus the Ingham County prosecutor and sheriff are meeting for a candidates forum. But here's the twist. They'll be fielding questions from a panel of eight teens who've come through foster care or had a brush with the juvenile justice system. they could have some very pointed questions for public officials who may one day influence their daily lives. Current State's Kevin Lavery will recap that event tomorrow here on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Katie Cook directed the program today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, Drew Hill, and Isaac Constance at the board today for Drew Hill. Thank you, Isaac. The Current State podcast, informative, insightful, indispensable. It's your connection with what's happening around Michigan and beyond, anywhere, anytime at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget, follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. Find us on Facebook at Current State from WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. See you tomorrow on Current State.